Be a pessimist. Call that a lie. To be a pessimist means that you agree that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive.
The table about to turn. The table about to turn. The table about to turn.
Good morning. That was a bit of a mashup of Sinji Zugoran doing the old mole song along with Janelle Monae's Turntables, which opens with some characteristically powerful commentary from James Baldwin. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Desiree Hilligers. I'm your host for this morning's Old Mole Variety Hour, where we bring you news and views from a socialist, feminist, decolonizing perspective. On today's Old Mole Variety Hour, we begin with excerpts from Friday's Juneteenth celebration in Vancouver, Washington, recorded by the Moles Sarah Chivers. Then Bill Resnick offers a commentary on the genocidal implications of Big Pharma's refusal to share the patents for successful COVID vaccines with drug makers from across the world. Then Jan Hawkins speaks with Judith Arcana about the documentary film The Janes, about an underground network of women in Chicago who provided abortions to women in the era prior to Roe v. Wade. Hawken and Arcana, who is a member of the Janes, talk about the film and the lessons we can draw from that era for what looks like a post-Roe era ahead of us in which abortion will be criminalized in much of the country. Then Well-Read Red, Bill Resnick, provides a commentary on the January 6th insurrection. It's been a riveting exposure of the country's former peerless leader, and it drew a large audience across the country, but Bill asked, will it amount to anything more than a powerful history lesson? Finally, we close today's show with a tribute to Dolores Winston, who died in May and was an organizer with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black, vigiling to honor the lives and mark the deaths of people who've died houseless in one of the most livable cities in the United States. Dolores was also a teenage volunteer with Seattle's Black Panther Party. Dolores' mother, Betty Owens, joins us in paying tribute to her daughter. And again, we begin today's show with audio from Friday's Juneteenth celebration in Vancouver, Washington. The event was emceed by Karen Morrison, a community organizer with Free Hot Soup Vancouver, as well as coordinator with Odyssey World International.
My name is Karen Morrison, and I'm a descendant of an African slave. I am here, and I stand proudly before you as a dream, as a prayer, as a promise that we would be free one day. I am here celebrating that dream and that prayer with all of you today, of the accomplishments of our people, our Black African Americans. Always be proud that our descendants will live on. Our ancestors cried, prayed, and believed that one day we would be standing here celebrating our Blackness, all the achievements that we've accomplished in the world. We're part of history, culture, music, songs, and we stand here proud to say this is who we are. I want to thank you all for joining the party. And next we have Alex for the land acknowledgement.
Bonjour, Anaï, Alex Sanchez, Andishnikas. Hello, my name is Alex Sanchez. I'm a member of the Little Shell Band of Ojibwe people, and I'm honored to be here today to give a land acknowledgement. We acknowledge that the land that we currently occupy as residents of Vancouver is unceded Indigenous land. Our area rests on the traditional village site of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes that made their homes along the Columbia River, creating both permanent communities and seasonal encampments. We also acknowledge our Black and African siblings whose stolen lives and labor built this country that we now call home. This acknowledgement serves to bring awareness to the story of our ancestors and the current contributions of our people, and to highlight the ongoing resilience and solidarity between Indigenous and Black people. We must continue to work in solidarity to uplift the collective power, leadership, creativity, and wisdom of Indigenous and Black people here in Vancouver and beyond. Chimigwech, thank you.
Thank you.
Vancouver Mayor Anne McInerney Ogle.
As we gather here to both observe the significance of June 19th and to acknowledge it as a day of remembrance and action, I'd like to reiterate that the City of Vancouver is committed to being an equitable and inclusive institution and to addressing the past and current injustices. Earlier this year, during our first City Council meeting in 2022, the Vancouver City Council unanimously approved an ordinance that formally honors Juneteenth, June 19th, as a new city holiday for all of our city employees. And we want it to be a time for all to take pause, to reflect, recognize, and understand the unsettling and discriminatory history of Black Americans, a history that many still live with today. To this day, navigating life as a Black American in our city does not come with the same privileged experience by others. Systemic racism creates barriers to safety, health, and wealth. And for those of us who celebrate Juneteenth and do not identify as a descendant of those once enslaved, like myself, I encourage us to interrupt anti-Blackness and dismantle racism every day. Even in 2022, everyday activities in our community often result in racist interactions. Despite the many barriers, Black Americans have time and time again shown resiliency, strength, wisdom, and courage. We want to formally recognize the significance of June 19th and observe it as a day of both remembrance and action. We are committed to making sure this holiday is more than just a gesture. It must symbolize our commitment to eliminating anti-Blackness and racism within the City of Vancouver's workforce and community. City leadership recognizes that there is still much work to do to build the trust and confidence within this area.
Reverend Joyce Smith.
Hello, Vancouver! Woo! Wow, I've lived here for 58 years, and this is a first for me. I'm very excited today to be a part of this Juneteenth celebration. Where I came from in Mahan, Texas, 58 years ago, we always celebrated Juneteenth, but it was just us. But now as I look around, I see a sea of different colors, and that lets me know that we have come a long way, baby! Woo!
They wanted everyone to know that when they were set free, they were now a valued part of our country. And I reiterate that for them. I'm so grateful for what they gave up so that I could be free. We still have those problems happening, but wow, what a great time to begin to heal, begin to change as a collective community. And that's what community really is. When you line yourself up with other people who put people over profit and they line up with you and they want to see change, it happens. As Black African Americans, we say we are here. We are here because someone survived so that we could be here.
The table about to turn. The table about to turn. The table about to turn, yeah. I've been flipping through my timeline, trying to get my mind right. My city cried out, I got to cool down, but I'm under pressure. Cooking with my Crisco, look at what my fist go. A renegade when I'm in a rage. I got to cool down, but I'm under pressure. I keep my hands dirty, my mind clean. Got a new agenda. A new dream. I'm kicking out the old regime. Liberation, elevation, education. America, you a lie. But the whole world about to testify. I said the whole world about to testify. And the table's about to, the table's about to turn.
Okay, again, that was Janelle Monáe doing Turntable, and before that you were listening to audio from Friday's Juneteenth celebration in Vancouver, Washington. And next up is Bill Resnick talking about Big Pharma.
Hi, honorable listeners. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I've been reading about how Big Pharma, led by Pfizer, Moderna, assisted by near all of U.S. big business, how they are successfully preventing other manufacturers from employing Big Pharma's patented processes to produce COVID vaccine for the rest of the world. As a result, about 80% of eligible humans on this planet have not been vaccinated. Now, why is Big Pharma refusing to waive their patents? Of course, for the huge profits. Because the federal government paid all the research and development costs and gave them the patents. With mass production, the cost to make the vaccines is less than a dollar. But with people desperate to be vaccinated, with their patent monopoly, Big Pharma charges $14.70 to some governments and $23.50 to others. This, of course, is causing hundreds of thousands, even millions of deaths from people who were not vaccinated who could have been, particularly in poor nations. But here in the U.S. North America and U.S. North America, too. But as they say, we have a duty to our stockholders, bondholders, top executives. At first, early last year, a year and a half ago, Biden announced that the U.S. would support the lifting of the patents. Biden then brought that back soon after when Big Pharma mounted a huge offensive. Lots of people have blood on their hands, and their justifications are hogwash to be discussed next. So Big Pharma tax waivers, the waivers of the patents, contending that sharing vaccine technology will, I quote, stifle innovation. Yet it has been massive public spending to the tune of billions of dollars by the governments of the U.S., Europe, Japan, South Korea, and others that fueled the production of COVID-19 vaccine. Similarly, the new mRNA technology on which Pfizer and Moderna based their vaccines was produced through billions of dollars in public investment. In fact, the majority of drug manufacturer expenditures, it's going toward marketing, not innovation, and also, of course, executive pay. For example, Pfizer spent nearly twice as much on marketing and sales as it did on research and development in 2019. Perhaps the most insulting of all arguments against waivers is the idea that generic vaccines produced in the factories of developing nations, they could erode public trust in vaccines because of the possibility of counterfeit products or a lowering of quality standards. In fact, it goes against their record, where many of these manufacturers have been producing generics for years, which are as good as, if not better than, the original brands. In 2019, the Serum Institute of India was cited as the world's largest producer of affordable vaccines, combating diseases like measles, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, H1N1, polio, and more. It suggests that non-Western vaccine manufacturers would screw up the process of producing COVID-19 vaccines. That borders on racism. Furthermore, there have been instances of Western drug makers making mistakes in managing COVID-19 vaccines. Big Pharma also argues that a broad waiver on rights to produce vaccines doesn't address the underlying problem of inadequate manufacturing capacity. According to this argument, even if producers in low-income countries had the legal authority to start churning out COVID vaccines, they wouldn't be able to because they lack the factories or technological know-how. This, too, is bogus. When U.S. and European vaccine makers have agreed to partners with foreign producers like the Serum Institute of India, which is the world's largest vaccine producer, incidentally, and Aspen Pharmacare in South Africa, these organizations had no trouble with manufacturing problems. There are many more firms and organizations around the world with the same potential to help boost the vaccine supply. Finally, when all the other claims fall through, the industry's last resort is to argue that a waiver would help China and Russia gain access to U.S. technology. But the cat is out of the bag. China has partnered with European firms already to produce the latest effective vaccines. For those focused on geopolitical issues, the bigger source of concern should be America's failure to date to engage in constructive COVID-19 diplomacy. The U.S. has so far upheld the patents and has been blocking exports of vaccines that it is not even using. Meanwhile, Russia and China have not only made their vaccines available, they have engaged in significant technology and knowledge transfer, forging partnerships around the world. With daily infections continuing to reach new highs in some parts of the world, the chance of dangerous new variants emerging poses a growing risk to us all, as I'll discuss soon. The world will remember which countries helped and which countries threw up hurdles during the critical moment. I conclude, the predation by Big Pharma is killing millions. It also creates the greatest of risks of the death of billions. Because viruses mutate, and humanity has so far been lucky, because all the recently surfacing viruses, Marburg in 1967, Ebola in 1976, Hendra in 1994, H5N1, bird flu, that's 1997, Nipah 98, SARS 2002, H1N1 2009, MERS 2012, H7N9, bird flu 2013, and 209-NET and COVID, that's 220. These have been relatively easy to deal with, but what if the next one has the following qualities? It's highly contagious and long-lasting in the air. It's highly lethal. And that carriers have no idea that they are afflicted until suffering symptoms unto death. Then in a world of patent protection, of limiting vaccine and medicine producers, in that world, viral outbreaks like COVID can spread to many millions and billions of people, each of them a site for mutations of something more dangerous, which of course greatly raises the risk of that doomsday virus. This is not some theoretical threat. No one is safer until all of us are safer. COVID-19 and all the vaccines and treatments have been developed by scientists from all over the world, thanks to basic science supported by numerous governments. It is only proper that the people of the world should reap the benefits. This is a matter of morality and also self-interest. We must not let drug companies put profits ahead of lives. We, including us in Portland, are at minimum obligated as fellow humans to get our organizations into coalitions that fight for those waivers. In developing this commentary, I learned a lot from Sonali Kolhatkar, Lori Wallach, Joseph Stiglitz, and Walden Bellow.
Roll on, Big Pharma, roll on. Roll on, Big Pharma, roll on. Your motive for profit goes steamrolling on. So roll on, Big Pharma, roll on. Helped us rewrite all our standards of care to ensure that your stockholders get their fair share. If we don't prescribe meds, then we'd better beware. It's roll on, Big Pharma, roll on.
All right, that was Daniel Mackler singing Roll On, Big Pharma, Roll On. And before that, you were listening to Bill Resnick on the genocidal impacts of Big Pharma. Next up, Jan Hocken interviews Judith Arcana about the documentary film The Janes, about an underground network of abortion providers in Chicago in the 1960s. Take it away, Jan.
Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Judith Arcana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's delightful to have you on the program today to talk about The Janes, a new documentary on the underground abortion network in Chicago that you are a part of. The film was released on HBO this month and is disturbingly timely, with the Supreme Court expected to overturn Roe v. Wade this month. So let's start by talking about The Janes. You were a Jane, how that name was chosen, and what the network was about. And then we can talk about some of the lessons in that work for the rough road ahead.
Okay. The group changed over time, of course. It evolved. It began with a college student who, to help a friend, got the phone number of a Chicago doctor who was willing to perform abortions. And then after that first time, naturally, because humans are humans, other people heard that she had the info. And so she got a lot more calls. And what she wound up doing was having a meeting with some other women who were part of the then beginning Chicago Women's Liberation Union in the late 60s. And she said, is anybody wanting to do abortion work? And what happened was they started out doing what she, that original woman, had done, giving out phone phone numbers of docs they had vetted, and then that the morphing, the evolution began. Initially, there were some performers of abortion surgery who were found to be inadequate, either on a personal level or medically, but a good number were competent, so that was fine for a while. Then what happened was the women wanted to do more and began to talk with the people who called, began to set up appointments, which we called quote unquote counseling, and was very useful. People would call, they would leave their phone numbers and their names on the giant answering machine. You remember when they were the size of refrigerators, and we would call them back and say, hello, this is Jane. And the reason that name was chosen, according to Janes who were there at the start, is that it was such a simple name, such an obvious name, such a classic in English, old-fashioned name, and it wasn't particularly common among women and girls at that time. So they would call, they would leave their information, a woman would call back, she would say, hello, this is Jane, you called, and then their conversation would involve medical information, how far pregnant they were, etc. And the Janes themselves, the members, soon began, as I say, to become interested in more than just funneling that telephonic information. And the upshot of it was that moving through referrals to counseling, and then to maybe even assisting by driving people to the address and so on and so on, the group ultimately learned how to do abortions, which in those days were almost exclusively DNCs for the first 3 or 3.5 or so months of a pregnancy, and then induced miscarriages for the time after that when a DNC could not be done, and became essentially a freestanding, literally free in the sense of untethered to the medical industry, and as you've noted already, underground. Now, it's true that with all underground stuff, there are whispers. That's how the underground of anything works, like prohibition in those years. You know, people would say, this is how you do it. This is the number to use. And everyone.
And broad networks of support are involved, including the officials of various kinds.
Who yes.
Can be supportive or persecutory, depending.
Depending on what they think is in their personal interest. So that, for instance, we know for sure there were police women who came to the service. There were the mothers, sisters, wives, mistresses of police officers. There were people connected to all of the different ranks and realms of society who came to the service. It was, you could say, an open secret at the same time that it was literally underground.
I thought it was very effective. The film was very effective in situating this work in Chicago politics. You got kind of a feel
yes.
for different things going on, including the left, other political dynamics, anti-war movement, the mob. And so I think in that sense, there was this interesting intersection of abortion politics and women feminists taking this work up as partly a critique of both the medical profession, which was very male and patriarchal, and also to some extent areas of the left. Can you say a bit about how the documentary takes up some of this broader political context of the work?
Yes, I think that's one of the, I agree with you. I think that's one of the fine things that the filmmakers have done by placing us exactly in the geography and the chronology of our time and place. And so, I mean, people were in the streets in those years, in the late 1960s and early 70s for the civil rights movement, for the anti-war movement, and many other important concerns. And one of the important concerns, of course, turned out to be of very little interest to men in general, but was of serious interest to female people, people with uteruses. And the service, while it is by no means the case that the majority of us were political activists, there were some, but the service was so woman-oriented, so necessary to the people then always called women, that it could, as they say, fly under the radar of even people in the movement. And I think that the film does a fine job of doing both things, the one that you began this part of our conversation with, saying they placed us so clearly in our time and geography, and at the same time show very clearly how this was of no interest, really, to the guys who ran the movement. And that was, of course, in some ways, very useful to us.
Yeah, during the latter part of the Janes, around, 1973 and 74, I joined the Feminist Women's Health Center in LA, and we provided abortion services administered by doctors. But there was also a struggle over and an insistence to keep some control over abortion surgical technology and techniques, because the fear then, and this was in 74, was that even with Roe v. Wade, that women would lose this access. And of course, that was some time back, but has proved all too sadly prescient. So that was a big part of the work and the film, was to emphasize not only the politics of access to abortion, but it matters who has control over this medical technology, particularly surgical abortions. How do you see the film taking that up, that question of the control over the medical techniques and technology of surgical abortions?
I think one of the really valuable things that the filmmakers did was to not only, of course, interview all of us who are Janes, and of course, we're old people now, and it's extremely, it's really, I gotta just say, it's super cool that they have these photographs of us in our early years, and then there we are, these talking heads of old women, and you don't see that every day.
No, so there's some wise old women.
Yes, well, even if you leave off the adjective, although I definitely go with you there, Jan, even if you don't say that, the notion of having the experts, the people with experience, be old women is not a common notion in this time. Anyway, but what you were speaking of, yes, the court did vote to, accept Roe v. Wade. They passed that. That became the law. But it was only 3 years, just 3 years until the Hyde Amendment. So really, our history is far more complicated than people realize. It isn't just in the last 10 minutes or even just the last 10 years that an assault on the supposed liberation of Roe v. Wade has been happening.
And I think we've also moved from just a narrow pro-choice, somewhat apologetic stance toward abortion access, to more of an open and broader politics of abortion within the context of the reproductive justice movement, and understanding, I think, a lot of young activists that this is part of a broader politics of the right, and that we need to approach this in the same intersectional way that the right wing does, in a sense. The right wing does connect access to guns, cutting back on environmental protections, and denying healthcare services for people, and yet has this all wrapped around the protection of the fetus in this bizarre way. But all of these things are kind of aligned in the minds of these right wing Supreme Court justices and in many minds of many conservatives. And I think there is that also in the abortion rights movement too, a broader call beyond just access to, access to trans care, to addressing issues of sexuality, fighting for the rights to raise a child, have childcare, addressing racism in the healthcare system. And you also have talked about, during that period, the forced abortion and forced sterilization of women, particularly Puerto Rican women, I think you had talked about, and other women of color. So those issues, I think, are more, perhaps more central to the abortion struggle now.
Yes, I think that is understood more readily and more clearly now than it was long ago. And I also think that it is what you've just described is part of the analysis. And I don't think that was the case for very many of us, and not just Janes, but people who were thoughtful and political in the late 60s and early 70s. We were beginners, we were just learning. And when the abortion rights, that was a phrase that was common in those years, movement suddenly became the pro-choice movement, I personally was really disgusted. And it was about not using the word abortion. That kind of reluctance is of no value. And I think that it is no longer possible for intelligent, well-meaning people to make mistakes like that. I hope I'm right that it's no longer possible. I hope I won't be proven wrong, that people are still being too nice. But that was really a serious couple of steps backward, choosing the word choice instead of using the word abortion. However, I'm cheered by the fact that now, in this moment when you and I are talking, people are saying the word abortion constantly.
Yeah.
And so, that's actually
to the extent that discourse matters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of ironic, yeah. But reality. Yeah.
Overcoming that inhibition around the word itself. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, well, yeah. I want to congratulate you for your part in this film. I know that there was a whole creative team of directors and producers, but it was such a joy to see you in this project and have that history and the legacy of the Janes, not just honored, but a kind of guiding North Star for where we're at now. You know?
Well, it's very good of you to say. I don't know if we think of ourselves in that North Star way, but we definitely have attitude.
Yeah, that's right.
And we were free to make that clear in this film.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yes. And it's along the lines of, yeah, old women should wear purple and speak truth to power. What can they do to you now, right?
Yeah.
And it's now on HBO. And do you know if it's expected to be available anywhere else?
I think it won't be available anywhere else for at least a month or so. But I think, too, that HBO is considering very seriously stuff like schools or socio-political cultural organizations, perhaps, showing the film, or theaters showing the film for some social purpose. That kind of thing is, I believe, under discussion right now. But it'll be on HBO for many, many months.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Judith Arcana. I look forward to having more conversations as we navigate the road ahead.
Yes. Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me, Jan, okay. And for doing this work.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
And there was Nikki, looking some kind of sad with tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a verb, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate. Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. But baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting mission should be your volition.
Okay, that was The Diggable Planets doing Femme Fatale. And before that, you were listening to Jan Hawkins speaking with Judith Arcana about the documentary film The Janes. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Desiree Helligurst. Next up, well, Red Red, Bill Resnick brings you a commentary on the January 6th hearings.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick reporting. I've been spending some time watching the highlights of the House of Representatives. They're hearing, after investigating the January 6th very odd insurrection or coup I found it riveting TV. The workings of the Trump White House, it was Shakespearean, a crazed erratic leader, an angry populist, and that leader's grip, a palace court of sycophantic advisors, weird hangers-on, a number of pretenders to the throne maneuvering, a first family trying to save Trump from himself. Most amazing, he came close to succeeding. With Trump pulling it off, Pence had caved, that delaying the certification, this creating clashes on the streets between MAGAs and the left in most big cities. Trump then, happy about that, chortling, then declaring martial law to keep the peace and ensure law and order and public safety, and the country then entering uncharted waters. Well, that nearly happened, but it didn't. Still, the coup attempts and the hearing and proceedings were raising and impacting a set of national questions, some profound, others tactical. Those questions include, can U.S. democracy, thin, troubled, weak, can it be fixed, even restructured towards authentic participation? Also, what's going to happen to Trump? Will he be indicted? If so, what if he's acquitted? It only takes one person in a 12-person jury. Could Trump have learned from his experience? He threatened he'd run for president again, and can, in fact, he decide he wants to stay on? It could happen again, and more dangerous. I think he's learned a lot. First, I'll go through the goal of the hearing, which was to paint the picture of the insurrection and its origins and organizing, as well as a frame and an indictment of Trump. It was Liz Cheney, a Republican, but fervent, never Trumper. She noted in her introductory comments that Trump for 7 months led his sophisticated 7-point plan to overturn the 2020 presidential election. So point one, President Trump engaged in a massive effort to spread false and fraudulent information to the American public, claiming the 2020 election was stolen from him. Point two, Trump corruptly planned to replace the acting attorney general so that the Department of Justice would support his fake election claims. Trump corruptly pressured Vice President Pence to refuse to count certified electoral votes in violation of the U.S. Constitution and the law. Trump corruptly pressured state election officials and state legislators to change election results. President Trump's legal team and other Trump associates instructed Republicans in multiple states to create false electoral slates and transmit those slates to Congress and the National Archives. Trump summoned and assembled a violent mob in Washington and directed them to march on the U.S. Capitol. As the violence was underway, Trump ignored multiple pleas for assistance and failed to take immediate action to stop the violence and instruct his supporters to leave the Capitol. In brief, Cheney charged Trump. He summoned the mob, he assembled the mob, and he lit the flames of this attack. Donald Trump and his allies and supporters, they're a clear from present danger to American democracy. That from arch-conservative lawyer J. Michael Luckin, who told the committee that in the third hearing. In the second and third day-long sessions, the assembled members of the hearing committee, they substantiated their case as the basis for an indictment. Looking back, what I found amazing, pretty astonishing, frightening, it could have worked, and some scheme might work the second time around. Pence could have caved, but if so, I don't think that Trump could have succeeded in taking and solidifying power, and then the country would really be in uncharted waters that Trump forces could not navigate unless he could prove he had legitimately elected or by cracking down on with a police state, which I suspect nearly all military and most police command would now resist. Unless the extreme Christian right, the white supremacists, and the militias had infiltrated the army and police to a degree that no one has claimed. In addition, if he declared martial law, there would be widespread worker non-cooperation, sit-downs, withdrawal from work, and capital, the corporations. They, too, would like to see him retired. For in elite circles, it's widely recognized that Trump was scattered, erratic, unstable, unfit to lead. My guess that in that uncharted territory that would exist if he had succeeded, the existing elites would arrange some sort of ruling apparatus much influenced by the military, police, top public officials, trying to keep things quiet while preparing for a special election and figuring out a way of settling things and returning to business as usual. Trump might imagine himself a potentate ready to settle scores, but my sense is that the power institutions in society would leave him unable to execute his writ because he didn't control the military or police. Trump surely learned a lot in his 4 years, though. If he runs in 2024, if he manages to win against the weak Biden, hobbled by economic and public safety problems, he will spend more time choosing his military leaders and developing relations with police. So what's next? Trump got defeated. Pence didn't cave. Trump is not in power. Indeed, the House of Representatives and Investigatory Committee has developed a convincing case that he committed several serious federal crimes. But will the U.S. Department of Justice prosecute, and can it gain a verdict of guilty as charged? The trial would become a national spectacle, dramatic, deadly serious, with vast political impacts, and covered exhaustively in all media. Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, head of the Department of Justice, has a real headache. My sense is that the DOJ can make a terrific case, but can't they prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, particularly as to Trump's beliefs that he won the election? More to the point, can he convince all 12 jurors in a country where a third of the people believe in Trump as their savior and the last honest man? With the court victory, Trump might emerge stronger than ever and able to claim that he has been the victim of a vicious campaign of slander from the left because the U.S. American people have come to see that it's he who supports the American working class. Okay, and this analysis of the hearing, the whole episode reinforced the need to what's known as fixing democracy. Indeed, before Trump, pretty much every observer found U.S. democracy to be deficient in near every dimension, in its mechanics, its structures, its rules, its eligibility standards, its advantaging people with means. And political scientists have devised many reforms that work to ensure free elections and accurate results, for example, requiring paper ballot and voting machines, testing and audits of machines, frequent backup of voter registration databases, and much, much more. But today, the Republican Party is on a campaign to lock in Republican political party across the country. Reform programs are being bitten back in all but solid Democratic areas, even reforms that would make it impossible to employ Trump strategies for ignoring the vote have been rejected. Still, the big cities remain liberal. Some important structural changes are possible, including ranked choice voting, that greatly increases the voices who get a hearing, who get heard. And it greatly enriches political debate. In the final analysis, though, only if we build powerful movements from below, to be sure more difficult because of the political structure, can the political system come to fair, secure, and participatory elections. Finally, it's worth examining the Trump's impact on the November election this year, the presidential election in 2024, and in continuing elections. Indeed, in the short run, U.S. politics will be in the shadow of Trump. Will he run? Can he keep his forces active and angry? Can he successfully reach out to suburban women and socially conservative Latinos? Can he fend off his Republican rivals, namely Pence himself, DeSantis, Hawley, and others rumored ready to challenge Trump and one another, of course? What is clear, a neo-fascist force has taken root in the Republican Party, and they must be defeated. But in the longer run, the big political issues are less about the wedge social issues and more about environmental issues, particularly global warming, that will take center stage, particularly as climate disasters become more damaging and dangerous. For the left, the goal is for progressive solutions carried by left movements and parties to be in a contending position, ultimately besting the capitalist solution when the people come to demand a wartime-like mobilization to save the planet. This then frames the future for the left. That is, working in politics to defeat the fascists, to support sexual rights and freedom, to gain disarmament on the national and international fronts, and to win the authority to direct the mobilization necessary to stop global roasting and maintain a livable planet. And that will require working in the electoral and in movement building. So this was Bill Resnick for The Old Mole.
Battle, mean mugging all these yuppies in shock and rock. puns and the lies. Think about the dead soldiers when you're driving your ride. When people die for the war, and daddy pushes revenge. I'm with the widows, the children, and the lonely best friends. I'm for families staying together as one. I'm not for the raids and the deportations. I'm with Victor.
Okay, that was Rebel Diaz doing Which Side Are You On? And before that, you were listening to Well Read Red, Bill Resnick, reading a commentary on the January 6th hearings. Finally, we close today's show with a tribute to Dolores Winston, who died in May and was an organizer with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black, vigilant to honor the lives and mark the deaths of people who've died houseless in one of the most livable cities in the United States. Dolores was also a teenage volunteer with Seattle's Black Panther Party. Dolores' mother, Betty Owens, joins us in paying tribute to her daughter. At the beginning of June, in the space of 6 days, I attended back-to-back funerals of two dear friends, my former housemate and mentor, Jason Reynolds, a longtime director of the Oregon Consumer League, and Dolores Loanne Winston, a formerly houseless activist with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black. These days, as we confront the multiple crises playing out around us, it's easy to feel paralyzed by the enormity of the work we're collectively engaged in trying to pull the country and the planet back from the brink of disaster. And for that reason, I think it's more important than ever to highlight the strength, hope, inspiration, mutual aid, and sustenance we so often draw from the friendships we forge doing movement work. So today, I want to take a few minutes to honor the life of Dolores Loanne Winston, whom I met doing interviews for the oral history collection, No Room of Her Own, Women's Stories of Homelessness, Life, Death, and Resistance, which contains a chapter devoted to Dolores' story and to her work with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black. Since the turn of the millennium, formerly houseless activists like Dolores have stood vigil in Seattle to honor the lives and mark the deaths of some 1,500 houseless individuals who have died outside or by violence in the city that spawned Microsoft, Starbucks, and Amazon. The fact that thousands of Americans are routinely dying houseless on streets and sidewalks, in underpasses and alleys across the United States is rarely talked about. Public servants of capital who are bent on privatizing public housing and extracting maximum profits from rental units have little incentive to educate the public on the fact that even a single night spent houseless can easily result in death. And the average life expectancy of a chronically houseless person in the U.S. is 50 years. These facts are hardly compatible with the business of rendering houseless people the scapegoats of policies that render homelessness inevitable. Policies that criminalize and demonize houseless people. The reality of death on the street blows holes in these narratives, which is what makes the work that Dolores and other formerly houseless activists with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black such an important national model for other cities. Every time someone dies outside or by violence in Seattle, Women in Black stand vigil outside City Hall to put a name and a face to the individual, to honor their lives and mark their deaths. When I met Dolores outside Mary's Place in 2007, following a Women in Black vigil, I was quickly drawn into conversation with her. As I write in the book, Dolores identified racism in its various forms as a central part of her life story, beginning with her childhood in a small town in Louisiana in the early 1960s. The love and security that she found with her grandparents, extended family, and in the African-American community in Rayville, Louisiana, provided a sharp contrast to the threats of lynching and other forms of domestic terrorism and racial intimidation that she both experienced directly and heard stories about growing up. As a child, Dolores also experienced violence in the form of physical and psychological abuse at the hands of a family member. After the death of her grandfather and her move in Seattle, it would be several years before she would find refuge in a family that took her in following a random conversation with a somewhat older student named Ethic Owens on the steps outside of Franklin High School. In my conversations with her, Dolores repeatedly credited her adoptive mother, Betty Owens, with having saved her life, giving her love and acceptance.
So one day, I went to school. I was going to Franklin High School here in Seattle, Washington. And I met this girl. And we were sitting on the steps talking. And so I told her what I was going through. And she said, well, I'm going to ask my auntie if you could come and live with us. So I told her, if your auntie says that I can come and live with you, I'm coming. And I'll leave right then. The next day, she came to school and told me that her auntie said I could come and live with her. And that lady is my mother to this day. She adopted me and raised me, gave me lots of love.
I met Dolores' adoptive mother, Betty Owens, for the first time at Dolores' funeral. Even after she left home at the age of 21, till shortly before her death at the age of 63, Dolores and Betty had spoken nearly every day and sometimes multiple times a day. Here's Betty Owens speaking about Dolores.
My daughter, Dolores Loanne Weston, died on May 18th, 2022. She was bright. She was funny, mischievous, dramatic, and an avid reader. She was also very opinionated, and she wanted to be heard. She was a great talker. When I came home from work, she would follow me from room to room, telling me about how her day had been, about something she had read, and about the plan she had for the two of us. I would go into the bathroom, close the door. She would open the door, come in and sit on the edge of the tub, and continue our conversation. Life was not always kind to her, and the road she traveled was often very rough. But she maintained a vision, and that vision was that the world would be a better place for all people. She championed the causes of the underrepresented people.
Given that I was struggling to access additional archival audio of Dolores by airtime, Betty agreed to read from Dolores' story. Here's Betty again.
I came in on the last of the Black Panthers. I was 13 years old, maybe 14. I was involved with the Panthers for about a year. I still have my tam. It was right before I got away from my biological mother. I worked at the free breakfast program because I was young myself. I was serving breakfast to the children. I've worked with WHEAL for many years. I've been a part of the Women's Forum, Women in Black. I've been in the marches with them. We open up a winter shelter here and at Lakeview. We help the public become aware of what it's like to be homeless. I also did some public forums in the churches to help churches open up their shelters. We would go and speak and talk to these churches. We were women that worked, that tried to have a regular life. I've taken in the homeless myself. I've clothed the naked. I've fed the hungry, because that's what I'm supposed to do. Those are the things that give me joy. I wasn't homeless then, but I would be downtown because I didn't want to be by myself. And I had a house. Sometimes I would come downtown and just get people that needed a place to stay and take them to my house. I just like hospitality, you know. Women in Black, it's in memory of people that have been killed while they were homeless. For the people that have been there, one of them, Tessie, was a wonderful friend of mine. Tessie was an Indian. She was living under the bridge because she got sick or something, but Tessie died. Tessie was one of the closest homeless people to me. I had two friends, Carol and Karen. Carol died a few years back, right before I left for Texas. It's hard on her sister because they were inseparable. We knew each other since we were kids. Like last month, I had seen a lady named Pat. Not long after I got here, I seen Pat and I hugged her and kissed her and we talked. Well, she went to the shelter and went to bed. She had a heart attack in her sleep and died. I remember them saying, Pat died. And I'm like, you guys are lying. I just saw Pat the other day. She was 51.
That was Betty Owens, the adoptive mother of Dolores Winston, reading from Dolores' story in the oral history collection, No Room of Her Own, Women's Stories of Homelessness, Life, Death, and Resistance. Dolores' words also live on in a play adapted from the book. The play was moving toward production right before the pandemic hit and will make it to the boards yet. An activist with Seattle's Wheel Women in Black, Dolores died on May 18th at the age of 63.
We live in a boomtown metropolis, a place where success is a weapon of war. Some people live in spectacular mansions. Some people can't afford to live anywhere anymore, but Bezos has the money. He's got all of that money, more than $100 billion in his pants. Way down in his pants.
That was Seattle folk singer Jim Page singing Amazon. And before that, you were listening to a tribute to Seattle activist Dolores Winston, who died in May. Again, this is KBOO Portland. This is Desiree Helgers, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many, many thanks to Denise Morris, who produced today's show, and to Sarah Chivers for the audio from Vancouver's Juneteenth celebration. Thanks also to Bill Resnick for his segment on the genocidal impact of Big Pharma's COVID vaccine windfall profits and on the January 6th hearing. Thanks also to Jan Hocken and her guest Judith O'Connor, who spoke about the documentary film The Janes and the lessons to be learned from an underground network of women abortion providers in the 1960s. And finally, many, many thanks to Betty Owens for joining me in a tribute to her daughter, Seattle activist Dolores Winston, who died on May 20th. We're going to play out today with Nina Simone singing Revolution. And just a heads up also that yesterday, KBOO ran a full day's programming focused around Juneteenth. So if you missed that programming, you can check it out online.